Hello, you're listening to a podcast from the Institute for Research in Poverty at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Dave Chancellor. For this, our March 2015 podcast, I talked to Zachary Oberfield, an assistant professor of political science at Haverford College, and we're happy to add a former IRP graduate research fellow who got his PhD at UW-Madison. Oberfield came back to visit IRP at the end of January this year and gave a talk in his new book, Becoming Bureaucrats: Socialization at the Front Lines of Government Service, which examines how public servants develop and what that means for how they act and how the public experiences government. When I sat down with Professor Oberfield during his visit, I first asked him to explain the premise behind this book.
So the basic idea is that at the front lines of government, where people interact with the state, there is a really important role played by the bureaucrats, the people who sort of fill those state agencies, from police officers to teachers to welfare caseworkers, all down the line. They're sort of thought of as, the term is, street-level bureaucrats. And they're important because they have discretion in that they can do things. Like if you get pulled over by a police, they get to some extent within their purview decide whether you get a ticket or not, or you know, teachers have a wide amount of autonomy in the classroom, and yet, you know, on the sort of from the democratic theory perspective, they're supposed to be accountable to the public, but there's no real way to maintain that accountability. And there's a famous book called Street Level Bureaucracy. It's a book that makes this general point that these are really important people, and they're always going to have some amount of discretion, and so they have this power. They're also important because they're the face of the state. Most of us don't have these often interactions with Congress people, elected officials, even if Americans vote or not. So they play an important sort of symbolic role in the state. So, anyways, my book is sort of asking, how do they become who they become?
Oberfield says that a key point here, and one that Michael Lipsky makes in Street Level Bureaucracy, is that these public servants play an important role in all of our lives, but that role is even more profound in the lives of the poor.
In part, that's because you don't have means, you don't have the ability to challenge a decision that's made, you know, whereas a person, you know, of higher income might be able to say, well, you know, I don't agree with that, or I think I'm going to challenge that in court or something. You know, there's fewer means, there's more likelihood of sort of accepting the decision, or not accepting it necessarily, but not being able to fight the decision. The second sort of reason I think of is why they're important for low-income people is because it also offers like an access point to government in a way that permits them to advocate on their own behalf. And so, whereas, you know, what if you think about definition of politics is like who gets what, where, when, and how, you know, they play a really important political role in determining whether you get that welfare check, whether you get that child care subsidy. And, you know, in the big picture of the sort of budget, you know, that's a very small expenditure. In the life of a person, that could have a massive effect on you know, a whole family, the well-being of a family. So I think that there's a particularly important influence that they play on the lives of low-income people.
The two main groups that Oberfield looks at in his book are welfare caseworkers and police officers. He says that in some ways, police officers and caseworkers are good case studies because they have a fair amount of discretion and they're typical of street-level bureaucrats in other ways.
They're able to make decisions on the job, even though they also are following a lot of regulations. And in fact, there's one of the arguments about discretion is the more regulations you get, the more discretion you get, because it gets harder and harder to follow each sort of rule that comes down the line. So it ends up having this sort of counterintuitive effect. And they're prominent, just like the way that Lipsky says that they are, you know, visible sort of entities of the state. And I guess there's one other sort of way of thinking about this. There's a sociologist, Bourdieu, who has a theory that there's the right hand and the left hand of the state. You know, the one hand is sort of provides aid and assistance and sort of comfort, and the other hand of the state is punitive and requires, you know, rigorous watching and, like, you know, sort of some of the things that you might associate with police. And so I think that these two cases sort of offer that both arms of the state, both hands of the state. And I think in that sense, it gives us something of a full picture. And in terms of comparing them, that would be it would be interesting, I thought, to see how they develop. Do they, you know, very different professions? To what extent do they develop similarly, and how do they not?
As we think about the processes that take place when people enter bureaucratic organizations, Professor Oberfield says that there are two main narratives about how bureaucrats develop their professional identities and behaviors.
The first one, which I refer to as the dispositional perspective, is the idea that who people are before they enter an organization is likely to affect how they act in the organization. And the example that I often think about in this regards is whenever there's a case of sort of atrocities, military atrocities, think about the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. One of the first responses from the Bush administration at the time that happened was, this is just a few bad apples, that these are a couple of bad actors who obviously came into the military with some sort of negative perspective on how to use their authority, and that's the reason that they did what they did. So it's their disposition. The sort of second narrative is what I refer to as the institutional perspective, is that people's roles and how and behavior is socially constructed, and we're affected by the places that we enter. And I think that perspective has a lot more purchase in academia, where there's sort of a tendency to think like that norms, existing organizational norms, things like that, processes, structures, influence the way that people think about their work and how they act.
Both of these narratives seem plausible, so Oberfield set about doing some empirical work to sort these stories out. He began his research by surveying and interviewing police officers and welfare caseworkers in a large East Coast city. The survey asked questions about their motivations, their attitudes about their work and the people they serve, and about their professional identities.
And the idea was to get them as close to the beginning of their time in their organizations as possible, so you know, day one if possible. And I administered surveys to sort of get that fresh eyes, time one perspective, and then to chart them using surveys administered to the entire population of entrants at a few different times to sort of see how they changed from that baseline response. So surveys was a big part. The second part was, you know, survey data, you can quantify it, that's great, but you also doesn't really explain what people were thinking. And so I selected a sample within this population of entering groups to have interviews with throughout the course of their development at three times to sort of say, okay, you know, you indicate that you think the rules are important to follow. What does that mean? Like, can you give me a situation and how does that make sense? And then track that.
The third way that Oberfield used to study these bureaucrats was actually to become one himself. He trained to become a welfare caseworker and did the job for a year, so he got to experience the role and get a better sense of how these workers develop. Oberfield then used the information he gathered through the survey data, the interviews, and his own experience as a caseworker to analyze three main questions and see whether the answers changed over time. First, he asked, what were the motivations of these bureaucrats and how did they see themselves as agents of the state? Second, what were their attitudes, especially about social ills like criminality, poverty, and racism? And third, how did they see themselves from an identity standpoint as an agent of the state?
And so I tracked those three things, and the easiest way to capture the findings is that, as you would expect, there was some change in each of those three areas. People, there were some differences between the groups, but at the sort of broad level, both groups changed a little bit, usually in a pretty uniform direction from the time of entry until the end of the two-year period. At the same time, it's complicated because the change was not particularly impressive. And like I said earlier, I think the traditional sort of approach is that organization, and when you enter an organization, it's this time of amazing surprise, and you have to sort of wrap your head around how do you make sense of this new environment that I am, and who am I going to be in this environment? And there wasn't radical change. And some of my I think my most compelling findings are that people largely remained connected to the entering views that they had when they came into the organization about who they should be. You know, is a rule follower, basically a rule follower on day one was likely to be more of a rule follower at the end of 2 years, even though they might have shifted a little bit about how they see themselves vis-a-vis the rules. So the sort of term I use is this differential continuity. Everyone shifted a little bit, but if you think of like a normal curve, people tended to shift in a particular direction as a group, but everyone also stayed very much anchored to where they started. Surprising in that respect, because I think that, like I said, the traditional sort of notion is that most of, especially the police, remake, you know, some of the literature suggests that it's this time of like, we take basically modeling clay and create police officers out of them. Well, going back to the middle of the 20th century, there's these organizational theorists who sort of have these almost apocalyptic notion of what it means to be an organization man and how organizations change people and oftentimes in negative ways. And I didn't find any evidence of sort of this radical change that you often hear about in the literature. So that was very interesting to me.
After hearing that there wasn't really dramatic change in the perceptions and identities of these public servants 2 years after they started their jobs, you might wonder how much consistency there is in the attitudes that people enter these bureaucracies with. So perhaps the story is that particular types of people become police officers or caseworkers.
So that's part of the larger point, that the people who are drawn to that type of work are not necessarily, first of all, they're not oblivious about what the organization is all about. People don't just get randomly assigned to an organization. They choose it. And so in that sense, the notion of an entry or a time one point is almost a myth, I think. And that's sort of one of the things I came away from, is that there are these deeper social connections between people and organizations that go outside the walls of the organization itself, i.e. through familial contacts, through friendships, through personal experiences. So just for the police, it was oftentimes familial. My uncle, you know, ever since I was little, they said I had a police-like demeanor. You know, they said that I, you know, I was suspicious of people, and that would serve me well as a police officer. For welfare caseworkers, it was largely the experience with welfare was one of claiming. Many of the women that I worked with, some of them had gone directly from claiming welfare to working in the welfare office. And so, like I said, there wasn't this amazing surprise, and there was a real, I understand what this job is about, you know, I understand what it means to be in this role, and some of the amount of flexibility I have. I mean, there wasn't perfect information, and I think, to me, that's the sort of nuanced way of understanding how this process works now, for me, at least, as I see it now. It's like, there is some sense-making that happens, but all the sort of broader perspective is already embedded in the person in some way before they enter.
As we're thinking about bureaucracies, one question that's really been highlighted in the last several months with the events in Ferguson and New York and across the country is how much it matters if the people in a bureaucracy, specifically a police department, look like the people in the communities they serve. So does making the police more representative make a difference in how they go about their jobs or in how people in the community perceive them?
So I think that there's a fair amount of evidence that suggests that there would be differences. Now, part of this is outside the purview of my book, but there's evidence from representative bureaucracy literature, which is sort of academic literature that looks at the relationship between how much a group of bureaucrats look like the people they serve. And it suggests that they have a variety of material and symbolic effects on the people who interact with them, making them more confident in a decision. For instance, a minority driver being pulled over by a minority police officer, it's a much different perception of, in terms of fairness of that interaction, than being pulled over by a white officer. On the sort of other side is like, well, if organizations are these sort of totalizing institutions that mold people, what's the purpose of hiring a diverse array of people if they're just going to be molded into sort of the generic macho baton wielding cop? And I think my research and a variety of other studies suggest that in fact, people do retain some connection to their identities, what you might think of external identities, and how they think about some of the findings from my research, how they think about the use of force. Minority officers and white officers had different views about how effective force would be in sort of doing the job of the police. And those beliefs persisted, those differences persisted, similar to what I was just saying about how how general differences persisted, those persisted. And so to me, that's quite compelling reason for making especially police departments more representative. Now, what that means in practice is, like, obviously the devil's in the details, and published this piece in the Washington Post, and never want to read the comments too closely, but one of the comments is, oh, so we're supposed to fire all the white cops and hire money. That's obviously not what I'm suggesting, but I'm suggesting that the recruitment moving forward needs to be done in a way that really makes diversity in hiring an important priority.
When we consider both the representativeness and the attitudes of public servants, Oberfield says it's important to understand the kind of role that these street-level bureaucrats play in sending messages to the public and especially to low-income people.
I think the literature suggests they play a pretty important role, and I think if that's true, then it is incumbent upon policymakers, academics, to sort of recognize that this is not like a vending machine approach to government. You don't just put in money and make a selection and it comes out. You really want to know the nuts and bolts of who the people are that you're bringing into an organization, and how they are going to sort of continue or change the sort of culture inside an organization, and how that might affect the people who are going to have interactions with the organization. And I think that oftentimes organizations try to say, we need new blood, and what that means, I think, is people who didn't used to work here that now work here. But it doesn't necessarily mean that they'll have different perspectives. In fact, part of what comes out of my research is this sort of understanding that if you don't make a radical change in where you get the people who work in the organization, you're likely to get people who share the thinking of the people that are already inside. To that extent, I think that's something that policymakers thinking about bureaucratic change writ large is something they would want to consider.
Thanks to Zachary Oberfield for talking about his research and his new book. Thus, you've been listening to a podcast from the Institute for Research on Poverty.